The United States is blessed with the strongest and most powerful military in the history of the world. There's no military like our military, not even close. Nobody has our weapons, and it'll be stronger and more powerful than ever before very soon. You know, we just approved the biggest budget in the history, over $1 trillion. Over $1 trillion. We have the best ships, the best airplanes, the best submarines, the best technology. But above all, we have America's military. It's the best people.
That was President Trump at the George Washington aircraft carrier and a base in Japan just hours ago, talking about how we are the greatest military power. No one else is even close in the history of the world. And we have with us today Colonel Douglas McGregor, a defense and foreign policy analyst, former advisor to the Secretary of Defense and highly decorated combat veteran. Doug, welcome back to the show, and interesting comment for you to weigh in on right at the beginning.
Yeah, I mean, it's marketing on a scale that's heretofore almost unknown. Before the 4th Infantry Division Mechanized went to Vietnam in 1965, Secretary McNamara said that it was the most powerful combined arms force in the world and probably in history. And of course, the 4th Infantry Division went over there and had 60% casualties within the first year. And we all know how Vietnam worked out. So we've heard these kinds of claims before. And President Trump is nothing if not a brilliant salesman. So I would expect him to say these things. But the rest of us have to be more sober-minded.
Well, and in fact, one of us is more sober-minded, and you are in a recent piece you published in Responsible Statecraft, where you say that on Ukraine and Venezuela, Trump needs to dump the sycophants. There's a lot of smoke being blown about big deals and huge wins. True military professionals would tell him the hard truth. That really seems to fit pretty well. I didn't even know we were going to have that headline there, but it seems like he is listening to the sycophants and people telling him all these things, because, you know, I have to suspect that he's being told that all these things are true, that we really are that good. I mean, what do you make of that?
Well, first of all, we should keep in mind that we do a number of things very, very well. The question is, are the things that we do well relevant to what we might do in a place like Venezuela? And for that matter, how relevant have our weapon systems turned out to be in a place like Ukraine? I don't think that it's a question of, are we strong or capable? We are strong and capable. Do we have the right mix of capabilities? Do we have the right people in command? Are we organizing effectively for what looks like an imminent intervention in Venezuela? Those are very different questions, and I have serious doubts about them.
And, you know, one of the concerns I have when I hear those kind of things, and President Trump, really every president since, I mean, you can go all the way back to Clinton and all the way through, they always say we're the greatest military power ever. Biden said it. Obama said it. Trump said it the first time. But when I hear this kind of claim that we are the best everywhere, and then that includes the Russians, it includes the Ukrainians and the Chinese, et cetera, and you say that we are hands down better than all of them, I worry that people may believe that, because I agree with you that we are very capable and very good in some areas, but to have this belief that we are the best of all of them and we could beat everybody else, I think is setting us up for disaster.
Oh, no, absolutely. There's no question about it. You know, George Patton said that the German soldier was the best soldier in human history. There was nobody better. I think he was probably right. The German military in the Second World War, certainly at the outset, and I mean in Western Europe, was unmatched. But he sent the German military into an operation in Russia for which it was completely unprepared. It was too small. Was overstretched and inadequately modernized. What are we doing? We're planning to go into Venezuela with a lot of firepower and then 10,000 U.S. troops, presumably army, augmented by 2,500 Marines, I guess. Is that really the right device for a nation that is 30 million, the size of England, France, Switzerland, and most of Austria combined? I'm not sure it is. What we don't know, and these are the things that count most of all, is what do we want them to do when they go into Venezuela? Is their job to launch decapitation strikes, kill off the government, and suddenly install Mrs. Machado who's apparently the new cause celeb for the neocons and globalists in Washington. I don't know. The other thing is, what is your plan for the Venezuelan army? Now, I'm not here to suggest that the Venezuelan army is battle-hardened, tough, and ready to fight to the bitter end. But they've got a lot of equipment. They've got some people. They're backed up by, in addition to the Venezuelan army, 600,000 militia. Will all of this make any difference? I think it'll probably have some effect. Can you kill most of them? I suppose if we bomb enough people, we will. But how many civilians and are we likely to destroy? How much infrastructure will be destroyed? And then do we make ourselves responsible for Venezuela? Make the whole place dependent upon us? How many refugees do we create that'll demand entrance to the United States, which we need not at all? We still have a problem here with almost 50 million people that weren't born in the United States, most of whom are illegal. What are we doing about that? And then, of course, you have the drug issue. We keep talking about this as though this is an operation exclusively focused on drugs. But there's not enough coming out of Venezuela to justify this massive military operation.
Right.
Colombia is a much larger drug hub. But do you really want to go into Colombia? Do you want to deal with these endless mountains and jungles? I mean, all these questions have to be answered. We don't know what the underlying assumptions are. But when you've got a lot of people around you who are, frankly speaking, very sycophantic, they are predisposed to say, yes, sir, we can do it. Yes, sir, that's a great idea. Yes, sir. And, of course, we've been down this road before. We went down it in Vietnam. And that's why in the article I pointed out that you've got examples of people that were not entirely incredible, but they were people that got it wrong. And, you know, the commander of the 24th Infantry Division said he was convinced that regardless of the state of training of his division, that when the North Koreans saw his units in Korea land and advance on the DMZ, they'd probably all give up and run away. Well, what ensued as a result of our intervention in Korea initially was a mass rout and destruction of the 24th Infantry Division. We reconstituted it, but it was beaten to a pulp and ended up down in the very toe of South Korea. Then you have the former commander of Military Assistance Command Vietnam, the first one. He had been Patton's G3, I guess, during the Second World War. And he said that the war would probably end by January of 63 because the South Vietnamese military was so good. None of that turned out to be true. It all failed miserably. So we've been victims of this kind of thing in the past. And then, of course, this drug business is reminiscent of General Powell's assertion that that we had weapons of mass destruction under development in Iraq, and that turned out to be a lie. So what is this really all about? And I guess to a large extent, it's about oil and gas, which is plentiful. It's the largest reserves in the world, supposedly. And I guess you could probably get, for the cost of extraction, 2 barrels of oil from Venezuela that you would get with all in the United States, only 1 barrel. So in other words, it's cheaper and easier to extract oil down in Venezuela than it is in West Texas. Now, I don't know what that means for the oil business in West Texas. It's even cheaper, faster, better coming out of Iran, where you could probably get more than 3 barrels of oil for every 1 that you extract in the United States. That means you extract it and then you have to refine it. By the time you're through with that, the costs in the United States are quite high. Much higher than they would be in Venezuela and much higher than they are in Iran. So I guess that's part of it. Do they have some rare earths? I'm told they have some lithium. And of course, they have lots of gold. They have gold mines that are operational. And they have emeralds. And emeralds are extraordinarily valuable. I guess they also have some diamonds, but the emeralds are tougher to get and rare. You put all that together, and I suppose that's the real incentive. Now, somebody told me recently while I was in Washington, D.C., no, Doug, you don't understand. This is strategic genius. I said, really? What is it? He said, oh, we're flipping the chessboard, the strategic chessboard, on China and Russia. We're driving them out of the Western Hemisphere. They're losing, and this is a very important signal to send. I said, oh, okay. Well, I don't think that China or Russia are going to lose a lot of sleep over what happens in Venezuela. they have a lot of other places to go to get whatever they need, particularly China. I don't think the Russians are going to do very much of anything. I think they'll sell the Venezuelans whatever they can, and they'll advise the Venezuelans, but they've already told them, you're on your own. You're going to have to defend yourselves if you're attacked. So I don't know what the strategic benefit or advantage is of in intervening in Venezuela. Now, you and I know Americans, and Americans will hear, well, we're blowing up drug boats. Great, blow them up. It's what I call the bombs away club. We're bombing somewhere. Well, that's good. Bomb those bastards. You know, what are we bombing for? Who are we killing? How does this help us? We all want to stop drugs from entering the United States, but that's why we have borders and coastal waters. We have the U.S. Coast Guard. We've got the United States Army. Between those two, we ought to be able to keep most of it out. If we're going to deal with aircraft, we've got tremendous early warning systems for people that penetrate our airspace. So I think we can do a very good job, a better job than we have done in the past. But I don't think we're necessarily going to be served by intervening in Venezuela. I think it'll end up becoming a cause célèbre for Latin America. And we'll see lots of pent-up hostility and anger directed at us metastasizing. We'll see hundreds of thousands of paramilitaries, potentially from Brazil, Colombia, and other countries come in. You know, that then turns Venezuela potentially into an open wound.
So well, it looks like that we're going to find that out. You mentioned about some of the advisors and wonder what their motivations are underneath. Well, one of whom we know, because he's very boisterous, loves to go on television, Lindsey Graham, talking about how Trump has promised him that when he comes back from this Asia trip, that the Venezuela and Colombia are high on his list.
President Trump told me yesterday that he plans to brief members of Congress when he gets back from Asia about future potential military operations against Venezuela and Colombia. So there will be a congressional briefing about a potential expanding from the sea to the land. Yeah. Was it illegal for Bush to take Ortega out in Panama? Was it illegal for Reagan to go into Grenada to stop Cuban influence building this big long runway? There's plenty of precedent here to do what he's doing, but the game has changed.
So you see, Graham is not worried about legality because on the one hand, he in elsewhere in some of these other comments, he mentioned, yeah, I know the Constitution says only the Congress can actually authorize military power. But hey, 130 times we've been done it since the 1973 War Powers Act went into effect. No one cares. So basically, there is no law and you can do whatever you want. What do you say to that?
Well, I think he's right in the sense that we've never paid much more than lip service to the so-called rules-based international order. That's a joke. You know, we've decided to go in and do things, and they weren't necessarily legal in the eyes of the world, and we have never cared. Well, we don't have to care. You know, there's an old saying, small states do what they must, large states do what they can. We can go, so we're going to go. We have the capability, we're going to use it. Now, do we need to? That's the question. And he's obviously 100% behind any suggestion of use of military power whenever it comes up. He was absolutely, you know, buoyant. He's extraordinarily happy with the prospect of now turning attention to Venezuela. Okay, we can set aside any discussions of international law since we don't particularly pay much attention to it anyhow. Does this make sense for us? How do we benefit strategically? That's the real question. And we have to look very carefully. If we can establish what it is that we're benefiting from, can we then achieve that with military power? That's the question. You know, it's this whole purpose, method, end state. What's the purpose? What's the method? How are we going to do it? And what do we want it to look like after we're through? Is this another open-ended operation that could go on for a decade? Or do we have some sort of timeline? Is there some limitation on the investment of American blood and treasure? How many people are we willing to spend? How much time and resources do we want to expend? These questions are never answered until it's too late. I think it's already too late. I'm sure when President Trump comes back, something will be discussed, but whether or not we find much out is open to debate.
Well, so I want to go down, at least for the moment, on this narrow line here with Venezuela. You've seen the armada that's assembled out there. I think it's like 14% of the U.S. Navy fleet is there and a bunch of other stuff. But it's not, it may sound like a high percentage of the fleet, but overall combat power, what can you actually get done with that relatively limited number of troops, especially with the Marines?
Well, obviously, we have enough firepower to level Caracas and probably most of the coastal towns and cities. There's no question about that. I assume that we want to seize control of something. Are we seizing control of Caracas? Well, that's not a minor challenge. That's a big city. Can we do that? I don't know if 10,000 troops would be enough for that. Are we seizing the oil fields? And that might be a very serious consideration, because there's always the chance, if you don't seize the Orinoco Basin, which is the primary concentration of the oil, that somebody sets fire to it, that they destroy the oil derricks. I mean, we've seen that before. It's a very expensive proposition to put those fires out and put everything back in working order. You know, then again, President Trump's talked about $1 trillion on defense. Well, that's nice. What does that do to our national sovereign debt and to the deficit that continues to rise? And it's rising by billions of dollars every week and every month. And it's adding to our problem of servicing the debt. Is this somehow or another going to offset the national sovereign debt? I mean, that's a good question. I can't answer that. I don't really know. I have my serious doubts. But there are probably people in the banking industry, they're facing a liquidity crisis. Maybe we're going to extract gold, ship it home. I mean, that's not a new development. People did that in various wars for centuries. You march in, you take over the gold, you ship it home. Napoleon Bonaparte did that all over Europe. It ultimately didn't help him. It did in France, but I mean, he did it. The Germans did the same thing in World War II. So, I can't answer all of this, except to say that when the hearings are held, some very, very tough questions need to be answered. And I'm afraid that people like Lindsey Graham and others of his ilk will run interference to ensure that the answers are never really addressed.
Yeah, he did say it. I didn't have this soundbite handy. He did say that a regime change in Venezuela would be a, quote, layup. So that's kind of where his mentality is on there.
A layup?
A layup, yeah.
What's that mean?
Yeah, so he's thinking it's going to be easy. So famous last words. We've heard that song and dance before, and it never works out that way.
Well, he may be right in the sense that you could get to Maduro quickly and either kill him or arrest him or something. I don't know. I mean, I just don't know. And then presumably install Mrs. Machado. That could provoke a civil war inside.
Right. Yeah, that's what I'm saying. It's easy. It may be easy to drop some bombs, but the mess it almost always causes, it's worse than what we ever had the original problem. We'll see how that works out. Listen, I want to expand the scope here a little bit, looking mainly at American national security in light of these individual things that are going on here, because I fear that there is too much concern at the top level, matching what you wrote about, that too many people are telling President Trump that he can do certain things or that certain things are possible, because that's what he wants to hear, as opposed to what is real. And I want to take a look, first of all, I just showed you President Trump himself from Asia. Well, earlier, Secretary of Defense or Secretary of War, now Pete Hegseth, was talking, and he's going to give some examples here about how tough and strong we are. I'm not sure these are the examples you want to cite.
On that banner, peace through strength. It means reestablishing deterrence. When you've lost it, it's important to reestablish it. And President Trump has done that, from the Houthis and opening up our shipping lanes. When you just give away shipping lanes to pirates, that creates problems. He showed up and said, no more. Or Iran's pursuit of a nuclear bomb, and he said, how about we send B-2s, 37 hours, over to take care of that, to ensure that they don't have a nuclear bomb. Or how about defending our own shores? Zero people crossing our border right now, because for too long we had an invasion of folks, and we don't know who they are, where they're coming from, crossing our borders. poisoning our communities with drugs. I would not want to be in a drug boat in the Caribbean right now.
Okay, good that we're getting a handle on the border. I've always been a big supporter of that. It's not zero, but it's a whole lot better than it was. Great on that one thing there. But when you're talking about your strength and you're talking about the Houthis, which, by the way, after a month, we just quit and we never shut that deal down, or that we dropped some bombs on Iran in a day, and somehow that's supposed to be a message to Russia and China and others to reestablish deterrence. What do you make of that mentality?
Well, I think it's ludicrous nonsense. I don't think we've established deterrence. What we've done, I think, is convinced most people in the world that they need to invest very heavily in their own military capacity to deny us access. I think things in the future will be tougher and worse for us than they are right now. Look, you're right. I'm 100% behind any effort at all to secure the borders. I think it's hugely improved over what it was. Is it perfect? No. Do we have 100% control? No. I would rather focus on our borders and our coastal waters than invading another country with the goal of somehow or another destroying what we say is the drug trade down there. Let's kill it here at home. Why don't we enforce federal law here at home? I happen to agree with what President Trump has been trying to do in that connection. I don't think it's been well done. I've never heard a strategic perspective on how to do it, where to do it, when to do it, and how what we are going to use to achieve our aims. I think all of that needs to be done. In other words, I'd much rather fight the war against drugs inside the United States and along our borders and in our coastal waters than down in Venezuela. And the second thing is that if you're as concerned as these people seem to be about the real killers that are out there, there are not some drugs coming out of Venezuela. I'm sure there are. Colombia is far worse. I wouldn't want to traipse through Colombia, through the back country, up and down those mountains, trying to find drug factories and drug laboratories. And I certainly would not want to march into Mexico. That place would come apart very, very quickly. It's an organized crime state. But most of the fentanyl comes into the United States up through Mexico. And the Mexican government is almost irrelevant. The president of Mexico does whatever the cartels tell her to do. If you go in there, you destabilize it, you're going to make it much worse. I don't know who's telling him what, but I do get the impression that if you tell President Trump something he doesn't want to hear, he fires you and moves on to someone else who will tell him what he wants to hear.
Yeah, and that's obviously a big problem. And then when he hears things that he does want to hear, it seems to result in actions along that route. So let me show you a couple of those he seems to listen to, and we'll talk about the ramifications of this. So first of all, let's now look at the Russia-Ukraine war, which we've mentioned obviously many times before. But now Trump is being told by Jack Keane that we need to double down and take the gloves off.
So where are we now? President's taken the gloves off. He said, I've had enough of this extended diplomacy. I've run out of patience with Putin. I've given him as much rope as possible. I think this is the beginning. And yes, these are real sanctions. Everyone who's looked at it knows that they are. They have to be enforced. It takes enormous vigilance on the part of the Treasury and the State Department to make sure it's working. And he's got a bunch of other sanctions in the quiver, not the least of which is sending Lindsey Graham and Senator Blumenthal's proposed legislation, which would slap 500% tariffs on anybody right. purchasing Russian oil. And so, the president has, you know, that whole ghost fleet out there of tankers. The president can go after that. So he's got more to do on the sanction area.
So all you got to do is just more sanctions, and then you go after all of the fleets that the Russia uses to move its oil around, and that somehow that's going to bring Russia to its knees when all of the 19 rounds of sanctions have completely failed in that regard. What do you make of that?
It's another Einsteinian moment, you know. What's the definition of insanity? Doing the same thing over and over and over again, expecting a different outcome. That's essentially what General Keane is advocating. And this time we're going to get the we're going to get it right. This time we've got just the right sanctions. In fact, I think the opposite is the case. Everything I see says that these will have almost no effect whatsoever. And what we've done is we've driven a lot of people away from us. Now, you mentioned earlier something about Japan. The president was in Japan, and he's now touting the new deals that he's got with Japan. The Japanese are going to invest money to build things here. Well, they've been doing that for several decades. There's no reason why they shouldn't continue. It's been very profitable for them. Just look at the Japanese automobile industry. There's no question about that. But what else is he doing? Well, he seems to think that now Japan is in his camp. So he's reduced tariffs on everything coming out of Japan and into the United States by 15%. But in reality, the Japanese are doing what? They're buying oil and gas from Russia. They're not going to stop. They're going to continue to buy it in great volume because it makes sense for them to do so. They're also preparing to sit down and finally sign a peace treaty between Japan and Russia because they know that's going to open up even more opportunities to cooperate with Russia, particularly in the Arctic, in Manchuria, in Siberia. And those are areas of enormous importance to the Japanese. They've always wanted to get at the mineral deposits that are there and the other natural resources. In the meantime, what did the Japanese do? Well, the Japanese prime minister essentially told President Trump he's wonderful. They love him. They're going to sign on to nominate him for the Nobel Peace Prize. And they gave him a beautiful set of brand new golf clubs, potentially the most expensive golf clubs in history. And President Trump thinks he's won a great deal and won a great battle. And Japan is in the camp. Does that sound reasonable? Does it make sense? I don't think so. But President Trump is into optics, theater. He likes to say, I cut this deal. I got the better of everybody. Now they're doing what I want them to do. But are they? I don't think any of the states that he's dealing with right now are going to do anything that is not already in their interest to do so. And that's the bottom line. So I don't see anything productive coming out of this trip, except that the Japanese are certainly going to benefit from their trade with Russia. They're going to do business with us, and they're going to do business with anybody else they want to. Their biggest market right now for Japan is China.
Yeah, that's and then, like you say, that they're going to continue to go down their path of their national interest, which most countries do. But there's also other countries that have national interest, and that is, despite what Jack Keane wants, is the Russians. And they are also moving, not just in the economic and the petroleum markets, which they continue to do, but also because of what they perceive as being the threat environment requires them to do things in the security environment. And you may have seen, I know you've seen the issue that the Russia now has unveiled a new class of nuclear missile, the Burevestnik, and that has some additional capabilities. Obviously, there was a lot of capabilities already, but Russia, with Dmitry Peskov, explained the reason why they developed it in the first place.
Россия последовательно занимается обеспечением собственной безопасности. Именно в русле этой задачи и происходит разработка новых систем вооружений, к коим относится вот озвученная система. Обеспечение безопасности для России является вопросом жизненно важным, особенно на фоне того милитаристского настроя, который мы сейчас слышим от европейцев в первую очередь. Европейцы действительно находятся в состоянии такой внутренней истерики, русофобской, агрессивной и воинственной.
So one of the big problems I've had with a lot of this stuff, whether it's Jack Keane or Lindsey Graham or so many of these other people that are talking about all this stuff we should do to Russia, they always think that there's no consequence, that the only thing Russia is going to do is just shrug their shoulders and cow down or whatever. And Russia never does that. They always do the opposite. They usually bow up even more. And now we have this situation here where the threat environment gets worse. What do you make of that? Or how do you view, rather, the dynamic to where we think that our actions never have counteractions and that we never worry about consequences for what we do? And how does that work out for you?
Well, let's look at it from the standpoint of Moscow strategically right now. What is the situation? They are going to sign a peace treaty with Japan, And that's very important because it should have been concluded a long time ago. And that peace treaty is going to open up new avenues for both Japan and Russia. It's going to continue to sell its oil and gas to Japan and other things. At the same time, you have a whole set of agreements between Russia and China that are working beneficially for both parties. That is going to expand. It's not going to contract, because for some time now, President Putin has concluded, as most of his countrymen, there's no future with the West. And so they have to build a different future in Asia. And at the same time, Russia has very good relations with Southwest Asia and the principal states of Central Asia, which are very important to them. So he's really looking right now at one dangerous front, and that's the front that faces Europe. But he also knows that if he's patient, he exercises some constraint, or I guess I should say restraint, that the governments that are plaguing him in the West are probably going to fall apart. That's certainly true in London, Paris, and Berlin. There's growing discontent. So there is on the one hand a recognition that these European governments at the moment seem to be incurably anti-Russian, but there's also a recognition that they are on very fragile ground given the states of their economies and the financial system. So that leaves the United States. Well, what is the United States actually doing? Is the United States egging its European allies on into war with Russia? I don't think so. I think President Trump pulled back on the tomahawks when it was made clear to him what the true state of our military readiness is. And I think he recognizes we're in no state to take on Russia in a war. Secondly, I think he also concluded there's nothing for him to win. He's not going to get a Nobel Peace Prize for anything that happens in Ukraine, because to do that, President Putin would have to surrender Russia's interests to us, and that's not going to happen. President Putin is going to end this war on terms that suit Russia. I think President Trump knows that. There's nothing he can do about it. And so he's effectively let the pot boil on the stove. Oh, yeah, we'll send more things down the line if the Europeans pay us, and maybe that'll help. I don't think so, is what he said, but maybe anything's possible. Does that sound like someone who wants to take a road of direct confrontation? I don't think so. Then in the Middle East, I think he is prematurely declaring peace, but, you know, that's at his risk. If the whole place blows up in his face, as I think it eventually will, he may regret saying a lot of the things that he has, but he's never really cared very much, because if you push him hard and say, well, you said this, he sort of waves you off and says, well, I meant this, and now I mean this. In other words, he'll change like a chameleon if he needs to in that regard. So that leaves us with Venezuela. Now, there's no question that we can muscle our way into Venezuela, that we can dominate Venezuela militarily, and for that matter, anybody else in Latin America. The only question is, does anybody care about that? In other words, we go in there, we do a lot of damage, we put somebody new in, and then what do we expect? The gold mines to open, the oil wells to pump, and, you know, we have eternal peace and prosperity for the rest of our lives. I'm not so sure that'll be the case. I think we're going to have a lot of trouble on our hands if we go in. But in the meantime, just the sight of U.S. military power dominating a weak country in the Caribbean basin, well, that's great. Great visuals if you're the president. These are my men. They're doing great jobs. They're the best. Nobody can stand against them. And I think everybody's told him very honestly, no, the Venezuelans can't stand up to us in that regard. So, you know, General Keane is wrong on Russia. I think President Trump has decided, nah, I don't think I'll go to war with Russia this week. So I don't see that coming. You got to look at what happens in reality versus what is said. President Trump continues to say, oh, I'm really disappointed, and I think they ought to get this war over with. And, you know, we have a lot of capability, too. Let's not, you know, we can match what they do, and they know they should know that. Well, look, we can't, not on land. We can do a lot of things at sea because we're a maritime power. The Russians are not. But they've got a lot of submarines, too. And those submarines cruise up and down the Atlantic coast. They cruise up and down the Pacific coast. They may not be that obvious, but they're out there. They, too, can launch missiles. So telling everybody, well, we have submarines that can hit Russia with nuclear missiles is a dumb thing to say. we're very vulnerable to that ourselves. We don't have any integrated air defenses. We can't shoot down an ICBM right now. Now we're talking about an ICBM with, what, 8,000-mile range? It's hypersonic, but then again, all ICBMs are already hypersonic. That's why we can't shoot them down. So what has really changed? The only thing that's changed is that the Russians have a new weapon in their inventory for which we have no answer other than to engage in mutually assured destruction, which I think is something President Trump wants to avoid.
Let us hope that he does. I want to shift gears here and one more zoom out, because I think that the bigger issue that at least I'm concerned about is not whether Secretary of War talks about how we can beat the Houthis or, some other two-bit military players, but what would happen if we had to actually fight a peer or near peer? That's the absolute sine qua non of the measure of whether you have a great military power. If you can keep your country safe against somebody who has capacity, which is what you mentioned a second ago. And that is why your article got my attention here, because you're talking about some things that really matter here. And this is, by the way, is in our the description field for anybody who wants to go and read it, or you can just Google it right there on responsible statecraft. But one of the first things that really stood out to me that I think everybody needs to get a sober understanding of is you wrote, quote, "American military power is in a state of decline that will require a decade or more to reverse." Why do you say that?
Because there's a tendency in Washington, and I think sadly increasingly in Europe, to believe that if you throw great quantities of cash at something, that you're going to change it. Oh, we have a problem in defense. Well, we'll invest more money. We'll find some new weapon systems, and we'll be on track. There's almost no interest in the impact of what we do on the people that serve in the armed forces. We don't seem to really value human capital. They're saying now that we fixed the recruiting problem. I'm skeptical, but certainly as soon as the economy crashes, you're going to see a lot of people that'll be very, very good, very smart, very capable, looking for employment in the U.S. military. And we should be glad that they do. But I don't see that happening immediately, but it could happen down the line. But even then, it takes time. It takes time to train. It takes time for technologies to reach a state of maturity, then to integrate those technologies with people, then integrate them within platforms, as the Navy is very platform-centric. They need different kinds of ships from the ones they have. It takes a couple of decades for even to make a dent in a new Navy surface fleet. But more important, we need a lot of manned and unmanned submersibles. In other words, we need more submarines than we've got. We've allowed the size of that fleet to diminish far too much. We have problems with people that are able to actually weld the steel on submarines. We don't have enough of them. It takes a huge amount of training and many years of experience to do it well. There are a whole lot of things. We haven't even talked about the integration of new electronics. All of this is overlooked in favor of throw money at it. But we don't realize that whatever we allocate today is not going to produce real military capability for perhaps 10 years. I came into the Army after the Vietnam War ended, but I came in while it was still going on at West Point. The Army I entered in the 1970s was a mess, and everybody who was in it knew it was a mess. And we were all playing catch-up, trying to recover from the squandering of resources and people in the previous 10 years in Vietnam. That took time. We recovered by the time you showed up in the late 1980s. Yep. We were actually getting pretty good. I'm not going to sit here and blow smoke and say we were brilliant and the best there ever was and all this. That's a lot of nonsense. But we had come a long way, and we were getting very good, and we had gotten a lot better. Then we went to Desert Storm. And if you go back and remember, all these retired generals walked in and said, we're going to have 20,000 casualties. This is going to be a disaster. We shouldn't do this. Even Colin Powell initially said, let's just sit in Saudi Arabia, turn the border between Saudi Arabia and Kuwait and Iraq into a new DMZ. And, when I heard that, I said, my God, you mean we're going to be stuck in this desert in perpetuity? This is insane. There's no reason for it. Those of us who were where the rubber meets the road, who saw the enemy up close, we rapidly concluded we were not dealing with some irresistible force on the battlefield. We were confident. We had confidence in our people, confidence in the weapons, confidence in the organization for combat, yeah, in the things that we had to be able to do well. We went into that in a high state of readiness. We crushed the enemy in front of us. At the time, I thought we ended it too soon. That's another discussion for the future. But the point was, we were introduced into this at exactly the right time and the right place against an enemy who was completely unprepared to deal with us. We haven't seen that since, in the sense that what we did initially was almost incidental to what happened subsequently. Getting into Iraq was very, very easy. It goes back to the old statement, how long is it going to take us to get the 101st into Vietnam? And the four-star, Lemnitzer, said to McNamara, I don't know, not long. He said, the real question, Mr. McNamara, is how long is it going to take us to get it out? And that's the question that needs to be answered right now in Venezuela. If President Trump is smart, being the brilliant marketeer he is, whatever happens, he should declare victory pretty quickly and get out. Because the longer he stays, the worse it'll get. For all the reasons with which we are familiar. For the reasons we learned in Vietnam, the reasons we learned in Africa and Asia. Now, somebody's going to stand up and say, well, what about just cause? Remember that? This was going into Panama. And all of my classmates that were involved in that when we were majors or captains, they all said, we renamed it just because. Because everybody concluded when they went in there that to get rid of Noriega, they didn't need to do all the things they did. They did more damage than was necessary, killed more Panamanian troops than was necessary. But fortunately for us, Panama was very small, very manageable. Venezuela is not. And those kinds of mistakes could have profound consequences for us. But I'm afraid there's probably no one in the vicinity of President Trump who's saying that. I hope I'm wrong. But we have too many people in senior levels that have learned over many decades, as you know, Dan, if you want to get ahead, there are magic words. They're called yes, sir. You don't bring up problems. You don't do that sort of thing. You point to it and say, sir, we can do it. It can be done. And then you go in there no matter what happens and you work real hard to make it work. And we know what that means. It doesn't work.
Yeah. And that's one of the apparently the reasons why we have the current chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Kane, because Trump bragged that he was the guy that he could get it done when everybody else said that it couldn't get done. I don't know what he's like now. I don't know what he's been telling him. I have literally no idea. He could be doing great work for all I know, but I know that that's something.
In fairness to General Kane, he was in an environment in the Middle East where he advocated the increase in the intensity of bombing and airstrikes. And that did have an effect. There's no question about it. Did we permanently defeat ISIS? I don't think so. Half of ISIS now seems to be an instrument of the CIA and the Mossad in Syria.
What was that?
Whatever. But the point is, in fairness to him, he was willing to step up the intensity. President Trump obviously liked that, thought that was very warlike. You know, Trump's always enamored of these Hollywood stereotypes of Patton and elsewhere, that he's looking for somebody, hey, this guy wants to fight, that's good. That sounds great, but if you go back through history, most of your best commanders frequently come back and say, no, I don't think we should do that. There's a better way. And they treated use of military power as a last resort, but they made damn sure when they did use it that it made sense.
Well, and that's what I want to go down the path in next. And this is something I thought was really useful from your article here, because you said something a second ago I think is really worthy of expounding upon. You said that when you came in the 70s, we had the mess that we had from the Vietnam disaster, et cetera. And then by the time that I showed up in the late 1980s, right before Desert Storm, we were in about as good a shape as we could be right there. So we had more than a decade of time to build up and recover so that when we needed it at that time, it was a solid force. We could have gone up against the USSR, which was still in effect at that time. And I think we'd have done quite ably, I believe. But here's the question now, where we have been, and let's just say the last two decades, if we were to fight an unexpected war against a peer or near peer, whether that's China, North Korea, maybe, or certainly to Russia, are we ready today to fight? And if we're not, what do we got to do to get there? How much time? And one of the things you wrote in that article, Gary, if you can put that one back up there, is you say the key strategic challenges for Trump is not to meddle in Ukraine, the Middle East, or Latin America. And you said that his top priority should be to restore American economic productivity and prosperity, because that's the foundation that's going to set the stage for the military. So if President Trump thinks that there's a chance that we could fight against a peer near peer, seems to me you'd want to shed all of those things right now and focus on the things that you talk about, that 10-year period. What does that look like?
The lesson from the experience in Vietnam and the post-Vietnam restoration of the U.S. Armed Forces is that restraint now can create capability later. And that's really the argument. If we're willing to exercise some restraint right now, go back, re-examine what we're doing, re-examine what we've got for forces, then there's a good chance that over the next 10 years, we can be back in the position we were in 1989, 90, and 91. But nobody wants to exercise any restraint. Now, what does restraint mean? Restraint means a sobering self-assessment. Where do we stand? What do we need and what do we not need? No one in Washington wants to stop producing anything until you can find a substitute for it, because it means money. Money to them, money to industry, money to their constituents, and most important, to their big donors. The challenge in Washington is always the same. Keep the money flowing. Keep it flowing. Don't let it stop. Somebody like me who walks in and says, well, the first thing we need to do is we need to stand down X number of carrier battle groups. We need to bring the remainder up to full strength. Then we need to completely re-examine the shipbuilding program from top to bottom. We have to figure out what it is that we really need, not today, but in 10 years. How are we going to get there? Where do we extract the savings to get there? You have to have a new concept for what you're trying to do strategically. And then that filters down to the lowest level. This has been done before. The British went through this before World War I with their Navy. And you had some very smart people that made profound changes in the Navy. And the result was that the British Navy, the Royal Navy in World War I was really too strong for the Germans or anybody else for that matter on the planet to overcome. And that's really what they wanted. That helped them to eventually win. Of course, they won because we introduced a couple of million soldiers into the mix and we started producing everything for them. But at least at sea, they could not be challenged. So what are we going to do to get there from here? And at the same time, when you begin shedding these things you don't need and redesigning what you think you're going to need for the future, you need to invest very heavily in this thing called the private sector and prosperity. But you need a strategy. You need a strategy for high technology. You need a strategy for industry. You need a strategy for agriculture. All of this combined, along with a new national military strategy, is what you call grand strategy, which we've never really had. We've never really had it because we sat over on North America, the big island between the Atlantic and the Pacific, and we really haven't needed it. And so, our big period of expansion that turned us into a major, major, major power is really between 1920 and 1970. That 50-year period, during which we had almost no immigration, very, very little. But what we did do is take all the various inventions and innovations that had built up over many years. We figured out how to assimilate them into the industry, into the private sector, and also into the military. This put us at a tremendous advantage. But we were not really engaged very much in the so-called interwar period. And when we did go to war in the Second World War, we went in with the largest manufacturing base in the world and the largest skilled labor force. We came out, and in what is nothing less than a miracle, we turned it all into commercial production. In other words, we were turning out dozens of bombers in the space of days because we built a tremendous assembly line. That assembly line literally collapsed overnight and started producing consumer goods. And it was very, very successful. That's all in our past now. We live in a different world today. We have to understand what is the world that we're in and how do we remain competitive? That leads you to very different conclusions from the ones that I think President Trump has reached. Do we need tariffs? In some cases, yes, tariffs have always been an instrument that could be used defensively to protect things for limited periods. But we've tried to use it as a hammer. And he insists, when, even though it's not true, that we're winning this big tariff war. All we're doing is we're feeding the fire that effectively moves this giant locomotive known as BRICS further down the track.
Away from us, yeah.
Debasing our currency, it seems like a good answer in the short term to keep the dollar weak. But long term, it's a catastrophe. We don't know how much longer this can go on before everything collapses. So we need a self-assessment. We haven't done that, and not a realistic self-assessment. And we need a grand strategy, something we've never had. And we were lucky that things worked out the way they did in the past. You can't bet on luck forever. And right now, we haven't been so lucky.
Yeah, and of course, the problem with that is that makes everything you just said makes enormous sense, but it's logical, it's grounded in history, it's grounded in a forward-looking path should you have a grand strategy. But I think the fatal flaw in that is going to be nobody is going to bring that to President Trump because it doesn't have an immediate payoff right now. And what you're talking about is something you have to invest, something that's even beyond his term in office. And I don't see a whole lot of prospect that he's going to go down that path.
But Dan, let's be frank. You can't blame this entirely on President Trump. President Trump is very much a creature of the United States. I like to think of President Trump as in many ways the archetypal American. He has fully embraced the microwave technology as a way to do business. In other words, I'm coming up with this. The idea is in 6 months, we get this. In 12 months, we get this. The next quarter will produce this. Everybody on the Hill is very similar. That's why I said, if you go up there and say, well, we got to stop building M1 tanks. Yeah, we don't want to build any more Bradleys. We need a completely new technological path for the United States Army and Marine Corps. We don't need more of what we've got. So it's going to take us time. We're going to have to experiment. We're going to have to look at different kinds of technologies. Well, the congressman says, well, then what do I get for my constituents and my donors? How do I justify myself to them if you're going to cut me off from all this income that I'm accustomed to that comes from the status quo? Nobody wants to stop it. And this is not a new problem. You know, this is something for your viewers. They'll get a charge out of this. When World War II finally fell upon us like a ton of bricks, and we were fighting for our lives in the Philippines, where we lost the battle and 12,000 good men rotted in a prison camp for the next several years as a result, we still had 14 regiments of horse cavalry. Now, this is long after the Germans had overrun Poland, overrun France, overrun Norway, Sweden or Denmark and the Netherlands. They had driven the British 8th Army in North Africa hundreds of miles back on Cairo practically. So why were we still maintaining all these horse cavalry units? And I asked, well, why did we maintain them in the 20s? Why were we maintaining them in the 30s? I mean, surely mechanization was the path forward. Everybody figured that out. What's wrong with us? Why didn't we come up with Blitzkrieg? You know, why were the Germans the ones that developed this tactic? Why were we so far behind the Soviets? Because they had produced thousands of tanks and they were experimenting. Well, there's a reason for it. It's called horse manure, because tens of thousands of horses all over the West produced vast quantities of manure. The manure was scarfed up, packaged, and sold to farmers all over the Midwest and the South. The horse manure business took precedence over the United States Army and its needs for modernization. So when you ask the question, well, surely when Douglas MacArthur was chief in 1929, or Malin Craig was chief in 1935, or Marshall was chief in 1939, why didn't they wave their hands and say, get rid of all this horse cavalry? Well, now you have the answer. It was a lot of money in horse manure.
Well, and this is a lot of different kinds of horse manure that's going on today that's keeping us from getting into that kind of a modernization that we need. I just hope it doesn't come at too high of a price in the future. We've gotten lucky, as you said. Don't know how long that luck is going to hold, but at least we now have visibility from what you've given us here today. There is a path forward. There is a way to get it done. We just have to hope that somebody will put you in a position of authority one day and actually act on your judgment there. That's what we'll have to hope. But in any case, we appreciate you coming on and sharing this today, because no, people can't say they didn't know in the future.
Okay. Thanks. Thanks, Dan.
And we appreciate you guys, too. Be sure and like and subscribe if you haven't. Also, a reminder, please let your friends know who may like to get their information via podcast. I know a lot of folks really like that. Tell them my Apple Podcast, Spotify, Podcast Addict. Type in Daniel Davis Deep Dive, and they will find us wherever they get their podcast, or DanielDavisDeepDive.substack.com, where you can find us in the written version there. So we actually also have some videos on that. But anyway, you can get, once your information, we've got it for you, because we are unintimidated and uncompromised to give you the truth that you need, and however you want to get it, it's there waiting for you. Thank you very much, folks, and we'll see you on the next episode of Daniel Davis Deep Dive.